Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. A history-making day today as President Obama announces huge steps towards normalizing diplomatic relations with Cuba.
Today, Cuba is still governed by the Castros and the Communist Party that came to power half a century ago. Neither the American nor Cuban people are well served by a rigid policy that's rooted in events that took place before most of us were born. Consider that for more than 35 years, we've had relations with China, a far larger country also governed by a Communist Party. Nearly two decades ago, we reestablished relations with Vietnam, where we fought a war that claimed more Americans than any Cold War confrontation. That's why, when I came into office, I promised to re-examine our Cuba policy.
The announcement was met immediately with resistance from some corners, most notably Florida Senator Republican Marco Rubio, who is a child of Cuban immigrants.
This president is the single worst negotiator we have had in the White House in my lifetime, who has basically given the Cuban government everything it asked for and received no assurances of any advances in democracy and freedom in return.
What do you think about the Cuban embargo? What do you think about the steps that taken today by President Obama? Is this a way to bring human rights and democracy to Cuba, or is this a surrender of the embargo policy? Call in. We want to hear from you. This is a community conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this half hour, Katsuo Nishikawa, he's a professor of Latin American politics at Trinity University, and Jeffrey Engel, he's the director of the SMU Center for Presidential History. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Jeffrey, let me ask you, how big of a deal was this today?
I think it's an extremely important step for the Obama administration, especially as it tries to find a new path forward after the disappointing midterm elections for the Democratic Party. This is a foundational policy, the Cuban-American antagonism, the Cuban-American embargo, this foundational policy of the United States for the last 50-odd years. So to make a dramatic step such as this, such as establishing diplomatic relations, perhaps even as a precursor to establishing better economic relations down the road, it's a tremendous step in line with the president's vision for how American foreign policy should be in the 21st century.
Do you think that presidents before him would have taken similar measures had they had the political ability?
You know, there's no doubt that the importance of the Cuban-American community to the politics of Florida, and of course Florida's importance to the Electoral College and to the election of presidents, had a dramatic tamping down impact upon any change in this policy. There's no doubt that previous presidents, President Clinton in particular, President Carter, thought that there were some advantages to allowing greater engagement, allowing greater trade in particular, to try to raise the standard of living of the Cuban people, with the idea that a higher standard of living would in fact help them demand more human rights from their own government. There's no doubt that President Obama, following this line, wanted to do this from the beginning of his time in office and finally has had opportunity.
Okay, our phone lines are open. If you want to call in, if you've got a comment about President Obama's history-making decision today, announcement today about Cuba, the number is 210-614-8980. Jody has called in. Jody, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I think that an embargo and boycott of Cuba has been a failed policy. And these types of policies have worked, like in South Africa, when the rest of the world was on board. But when we have our neighbors like Mexico and Canada and everybody else in the world who are not participating in this embargo, it really is a failed policy. And I think we'd have much more influence on Cuba, on their democratization, and on especially their economic policy, if we were able to exert our own economic influence through vacation dollars and investment. And just like you said earlier, raising the standard of living for the Cuban people. I think that the embargo creates resentment from within and just kind of helps to stagnate the process. And I'm really glad that the president had the courage and vision to change the policy. And no matter what he does, if it's great or not, it's going to be with resistance from especially from the Republican Tea Party element. So I'm not expecting any praise from them at all.
All right, Jody, thank you for your comments. Appreciate that. So let me ask you, Katsu, professor of Latin American politics at Trinity University. You've been to Cuba. You've taken students with you from Trinity to see what life was like there. What were the impacts of the embargo that you saw?
Well, at one level, you can see that there's tangible, you know, physical need in Cuba, right? You see old cars and dilapidated buildings. But when you talk to people, you get a really interesting sense, both at the kind of like the street level or with people, you know, within the government or academics. And it's a very nuanced understanding of what the embargo is and who's to blame and why it is. And for most Cubans, I think they're very clear in saying, right, that they have nothing against the American people, nothing against the politicians in Washington. For them, they see this more as a kind of the counter-revolutionary faction that is entrenched in Miami, and that they have this extraordinary amount of political power, and that they bend U.S. foreign policy in ways that affect negatively Cuba.
So the counter-revolutionary faction, these are the people that fled Cuba when Castro took power. These were the educated upper-class people of Cuba. And then they went to southern Florida, and they have had a grudge since then.
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, the counter-revolutionary label, right, that's what the Cubans call them. You know, we see them as the, you know, these exiles. And but it's basically they've been very organized, very vocal. They are the stalwarts of this policy. The interesting thing is that, you know, some polls have come out, especially some stuff from the Pew Research Center, and it tends to see, what's showing is that there's a shift within generations, that the older Cubans, people who were born on the island and left in this first wave, they're still very anti-Castro. But for younger generations, people who were born in the U.S., they tend to have a much more positive and, or not so much as a negative view of Fidel and his brother, Raul.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Jorge has called in. Let's get him on the air. Hey, Jorge, you're on the air.
Hi. Listen, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Cuban-American. I was born in 62. I was born in 61. I left in 62 and came to the U.S. Went to the University of Florida and have lived in the U.S., in Mexico, and in Europe, working for several companies. I am very pleased with the change in policy for the U.S. I had one of my cousins who lives in Cuba came to visit, and he shared about the situation in the island and the challenges that they face just to be fed. And and I think that the fact that this policy, which, you know, after 50 years, it's about time that we decide to try something different. This policy change may really help the island significantly and help us have dialogue that we haven't had in the past. I think the other thing that will happen is that one of the reasons that the Castro brothers blamed the problems in Cuba about was because of this embargo. Even though they can trade with just about every other country in the world, they were saying that a lot of the problems they were facing was because
of the United States.
The U.S. Yeah, the U.S. had...
Real quick question, because I got to go to break real quick. But Jorge, would you go back? Are you like a citizen? Could you go back to Cuba? You were born there?
I was born in Cuba.
Would you go back?
I'll go back to visit, but I am a U.S. citizen. This is my country.
Okay. All right. Well, Jorge, thank you for calling in. Appreciate your insight. We're going to take a quick break. The phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about President Obama's announcement today about taking some steps towards normalizing diplomatic relations with Cuba. The embargo is still in place because that's a congressional action that needs to be happening. But the executive office can do lots of things. They're trying to open up embassies in Havana, and Cuba can open up an embassy in Washington, D.C. if they can find real estate, if that is. Let's get Alex on the air. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because I'm a young American. I'm only 21. But from everything I see, it's a completely failed policy that who it targets. It's meant to target the government and to pressure them into giving their people more rights and for us to have more say in what happens in their government. But it really only hurts the people. And at a time when most of the people aren't staunch supporters of this government, you're punishing them for something that's not even their fault.
Okay, Alex, thank you for your call. Appreciate those comments.
Can I jump in, Jeff?
Go ahead.
You know, I think one thing, I think the caller hits upon a very important issue, but one thing to remember is that the entire rationale for strategic embargoes of any kind and economic warfare more broadly is, in fact, to pain the people, to hurt the people that are being oppressed by their own government. Because if they suffer enough pain, the theory goes, they themselves will rise up and throw out their dictatorial regime. So lately, in the last 10, 15 years, there's been a lot of work to try to have targeted sanctions, to target only the regime members. But the overall policy that was undertaken 50 years ago was essentially to do exactly what the caller just described, intentionally so, to make life so miserable for Cubans that they, in fact, would get rid of the government of their own volition. That's the policy that seems to have failed, that despite 50 years of hardship, there simply has not been the domestic-generated desire to get rid of the Castros in large part because the times have been so difficult that it's hard to generate a lot of animosity, it's hard to generate a lot of enthusiasm when people are simply struggling to find their daily bread.
All right. Thank you for those comments, Alex. And Kasu, you want to join?
Yeah, I have this problem when I teach this about the embargo, right, explaining what it is to students, and they're flabbergasted as how is it possible that is still going on. And if the Castro regime did not collapse in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapsed and stopped aiding them, it's not going to collapse anytime soon because of the embargo.
Well, when the United States put the embargo in place on Cuba, what happened to Cuba? I mean, it seemed like the drive Cuba closer to the Soviet Union than they had before.
Yeah, so the Cubans, or Castro, was not a communist as he later kind of became more a socialist, but he was very much a nationalist. He believed in developing Cuba for Cubans and having the economic resources of Cuba benefit Cubans. And that's kind of like the platform that brought him into power. But these kind of like the nationalization of certain things really rubbed the U.S. senators and other politicians the wrong way, and they pressured in the embargo. Once the embargo was in, that kind of opened the path toward becoming an ally of the Soviets.
And before the revolution, Cuban Revolution, I mean, just 50 miles off the coast of Florida, there was this country. It was known as a playground, and there were it was not a good place.
There was lots of prostitution, drinking, gambling. So some of the first things that happened on January 1st after the revolution, after Batista leaves, is that people went into the casinos, hauled out the gambling equipment and burnt it. Right? They really, that was something that was kind of a plight on society as they saw it.
Okay, back to the phone lines. Anna, I got Anna on now finally. Anna, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. I'm actually one of the students that went on the Cuba trip with Dr. Nishikawa.
Hi, Anna.
And I just wanted to say that that experience was so educational and extremely rewarding. I'm getting to meet with people, private business owners, which was a new thing at the time in Cuba, just gave me a chance to really understand the situation. So meeting with private business owners, meeting with people all across the island, it was really a great experience, and I think that with this opening of relations between our two countries, I think that there's some great things to come from this.
Well, Anna, let me ask you, human rights comes up all the time. We got to talk about human rights with Cuba. How do you factor that in? How do you weigh it?
I mean, I think it's definitely an issue. I'm not particularly educated on the subject, but I think it's something that needs to be looked at for sure, and it's been a problem in the past, and I think it's going to be something that's important when determining how our future relationship with Cuba is going to be shaped.
Okay, Anna, thank you for your comments. Appreciate that. Jeff Engel at SMU, what should we do about, is it human rights? What about it over at Cuba? I mean, they're terrible, right?
They are terrible, and this is an area where I think there is a deep divide within American policymaking over essentially which is the chicken and which is the egg, whether human rights should be the issue that we put our foot down and say we're not going to deal with regimes that have terrible human rights records, or whether we say instead that we need to specifically deal with those regimes in order to help those people, in order to help those people change their own government. This is something around the world where we've seen governments that essentially been engaged by the United States, seen human rights improve, never so much as much as we would like, but certainly in lots of cases around the world, especially at the end of the Cold War, we saw governments that simultaneously were able to embrace market reforms, embrace greater economic prosperity, and that prosperity in itself helped generate a greater desire for human rights among the populations that were being oppressed. So when we put our foot down and say we're simply not going to deal with countries that have difficult human rights records, to some minds, mine in particular, that simply means that we're abandoning those people, which is something I'm not comfortable doing.
And Katsu, how do you think about the human rights with Cuba compared to other countries that we have relations with?
Well, yeah, you know, in that sense, it's a kind of selective finger pointing going on. The U.S. has perfect relationships with China, Mexico, you know, Central American countries like Honduras, and you know, they have equal or even worse human rights records than Cuba. I think Jeff is right in saying that, you know, we should engage. And once we engage with the Cuban government and they get something from us through, you know, trade and other forms of benefits, then you can say, okay, you know, the next step is conditional on these improvements. But it's very important to first engage and have a dialogue and have a relationship that you can use as a platform to start to negotiate on human rights.
Back to the phone lines with David. He's called in. David, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just think I was 9 years old during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and many people don't understand just how close we were to nuclear war. So I understand how this all came about and the feelings that started in the beginning. But to me, it's 50 years later now plus, and the Republican Party just is constantly afraid of offending the Cuban exile community or whatever in South Florida, and it's about time that we did this. it hasn't worked. Our other policy hasn't worked for so long, and what makes people think that continuing it is going to work? And people like Marco Rubio come on there, and I don't know if the Republicans think he's their great hope of winning the Hispanics over, but I think they're sorely mistaken. The guy is just listening to him with his choppy, right, annoying voice.
Okay, David, we're not talking about Marco Rubio here. Okay, that's another time. But thank you for your comments
well,
about
you
Cuba.
Put him on earlier, so.
All right, thank you, sir. All right, so Jeff, let me ask you, though. I mean, I'm kind of worried about Cuba here. I mean, if the United States goes full throttle into dropping the embargo, I mean, that's kind of like, you know, we're a giant economy next to this tiny little economy. It could be swallowed up, right?
Well, I don't know entirely what swallowed up means in that context. I mean, I think there would be a great influx of tourism. There would be a great influx of financial and economic opportunity. And, of course, that does bring downsides. That's going to, as with any prosperity, that brings the possibility of corruption. That brings the possibility of enhanced crime and prostitution and gambling, as was mentioned earlier. But I think one of the interesting analogies that one can use, one of the interesting comparisons, if you will, looking back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and looking back to the difficulties of the 1960s to try to understand just how anomalous our policy towards Cuba to this day is look at a country like Vietnam, one of the most bitter defeats the United States has ever suffered internationally. 50,000 soldiers, American soldiers died, several million Vietnamese died during numerous conflicts, and yet today we are capable of having trade relations with Vietnam, there's tourism with Vietnam, and relations are improving with Vietnam despite a very difficult Vietnamese human rights record.
the fact that, you know, after the 50 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis which by most historians' accounts, no matter how terrible we view it, was one that the Americans by and large came out as the victors, if you can have a victor in a crisis, John Kennedy was that, then it's really remarkable that we are still bitter over something in which we won, whereas in the case of Vietnam, we are entirely happy to deal with people who defeated us.
And Katsu, what I mean by this thing about the United States swallowing Cuba, Cuba now has a wonderful culture, character, identity. The cross-contamination between trades doesn't always work out.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we can benefit a lot from Cuba. I think there's a plenty of listeners who can't wait until they can get their hands on Cuban cigars, right? And the rum is especially,
and they can have good. Our Coca-Cola.
Yeah, but this is where a positive thing can happen, right? So there's plenty of businesses right now that sell things to Cuba from the U.S. and they sell it. They have to pay cash, the Cubans, and that's the only way. But if in the future more businesses can start thinking about, you know, expanding into Cuba, they can pressure the government, and
all right,
that can be a way out.
A future for Cuba, United States. President Obama announcing huge steps today towards normalization of diplomatic ability there. And this is The Source on KSTX. Thank both of our guests, Jeffrey Engel and Katsu Nakashiya. I'm sorry, I messed that up. Nishikawa. All right, thank you. This is The Source.